Welcome to the Well Workplaces podcast, where we explore the intersection of health, productivity, and culture in today's workplaces. I'm your host, Tom Bosner, and I'm thrilled to be bringing you another exciting episode today with another international guest by the name of Topaz Adizes. Topaz is an Emmy Award-winning writer, director, and experienced design architect. He's an Edmund Hillary Fellow and Sundance Skull Stories of Change Fellow. His works have been selected to Cannes, Sundance, and featured in New Yorker Magazine, Vanity Fair, and the New York Times. He has garnered an Emmy for New Approaches to Documentary and two World Press Photo Awards for Immersive Storytelling and Interactive Documentary. He's currently the founder and executive director of the experience design studio called The Skin Deep. Topaz studied philosophy at UC Berkeley and Oxford University, and he speaks four languages and currently lives in Mexico with his wife and two children. For more information about The Skin Deep, and I'd highly recommend having a look at this interesting project, check out theskindeep.com. Before we head across to the show, I do have one small favour to ask, and that is that you click follow or subscribe on whatever platform you are on. Essentially, more followers and more subscribers for the show, the better the content and the better the reach for our platform. Thanks so much. I appreciate it. Let's get across to the show. Welcome to the show, Topaz from Mexico. How are you doing, mate?
Hey, Tom. It's good to be here, man. Good to be here.
I've been excited to have this conversation with you. I've just recently read your book and have been fascinated by how you've been able to talk about asking questions and how to build deeper connections. So the book, of course, is called 12 Questions for Love, A Guide to Intimate Conversations and Deeper Relationships. And Topaz, you had me at the first, I think it was one of the first sentences or first paragraphs. And the question was, have you ever found yourself in the presence of someone you love dearly and had nothing to say? And you had my head going like this straight away with that particular question. And that sort of hooked me into the rest of the book. Really good question there. And I think that's really relatable for a lot of people where, yeah, maybe it's your partner, your family members. We are in relationships with a lot of people in our inner circles, and sometimes things get a little bit stale and or routine, and we kind of get a bit stuck with our connection. Yeah, tell us about what sort of led you down this route of this type of work. I've watched The End and the docuseries that you created there, which for those that haven't heard of it, it's an interactive documentary looking at 30 couples discussing really big topics. Tell us the start of your journey, Topaz.
Well, thank you so much. So Tom, the book is 12 Questions for Love, and I would love to know if you're going to actually ask your partner those 12 questions and have the conversation with them. That would be interesting. The idea is, you know, it's based on The End that you're speaking of, but it's not 30 couples. It's actually, this is 10 years later and 1,200 pairs later of all kinds of relationships. Oh, wow. Grandparents with grandchildren, best friends, lovers, people who are getting divorced or have broken up and meeting up again, sisters, siblings, everything you can imagine. We have held the space for over 1,200 conversations. And so what's distilled in the book, and really my learnings, is how to create an experience for people to have deeper, more meaningful conversations. And the equation is quite simple. You know, you've heard the idea, you know, from Esther Perel and other thought leaders, where they say, you know, the quality of your life is determined by the quality of your relationships. But what determines or what supports the quality of your relationships? Well, I suggest it's conversation. Well, then what creates powerful, deeper, more quality conversations? It's the space you create in which you ask and inquire with well-constructed questions. That's how we can create a different kind of conversation. And when you're nodding your head in the one point, the sentence where, I mean, this happens all the time. You're sitting across from your father, from your brother, sister, from your best friend, you know, you're sitting there from your partner and you're at dinner and you've taken the time to do your date night or your friend's time or your conversation. You happen to be on the beach together or just sitting on the bus or in the car, and you're not really talking because you feel like everything has been said, and you feel maybe as though, I don't know what question to ask, or you feel even if I ask a question, they'll give me the response I know they'll give me. And so we are kind of lost in how to have these deeper, more meaningful conversations. And frankly, this is not something we're taught. We're not taught this in school. Really, the places we're taught this is what we model in our own families. And fortunately, for the last 10 years, my team and I, we've held a space for over 1,200 conversations. You can fall into this rabbit hole on all the social media channels over these incredible conversations that we have. And we found how to construct a space for people to have these moments. And it does come down to the space, and more fundamentally, the questions you ask. Are you asking well-constructed questions? And in this conversation, we can go into like what makes a good, well-constructed question. But that's really the learning, and that's kind of where the information that I'm coming at in this conversation with you.
Yeah, I love that. And to answer your question, I am putting, we've got some time aside later today.
Beautiful.
This is pretty ridiculous. We're both working from home, and we've set up a meeting yeah. calendar to actually spend some time to have a conversation.
That's
which,
so important.
Is kind of new for us. And I must admit your book and the 12 questions in particular got me thinking about this. And I did share some of these questions with some colleagues to my male colleagues and said, oh, this could be good to ask your wife. Because I think I've been married for 10 years, mm-hmm. been together for, I don't know, maybe 17, about 70 years perhaps. And yeah, we do have the date nights, and you do have we have two kids as well. It's busy at home, yeah. similar to yourself with two kids. Time goes fast. Work gets in the way. Also and these are just still excuses, also sometimes an intimacy blocker or a deeper connection blocker. There's other things coming at us, like, you know, the distraction of our phones and whatever's happening in the media is there for instant hits of dopamine. I feel like if you take a picture of a modern couple these days at about 8 p.m. at night, they're probably sitting on the couch, both with their phones out, not communicating or having a better relationship with their phone than each other, perhaps.
If you look at your life, if you look, I'm talking to the listener now, in our yes. own, you and I, if you look at the effort you put in, it's commensurate to the payoff. You put a lot of effort, the payoff is going to be greater. You put a little bit of effort, the payoff is smaller. When you see couples, when you see families sitting at the dinner table and they're on their phones, they're all scrolling. This happens all the time. We see this all the time. People are on their phones. They are getting quicker dopamine hits, smaller ones, albeit, but quicker ones with really little effort. Scroll, 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 new information, scroll, scroll, you know, whatever it is. They're getting these little small dopamine hits from small effort. What I'm suggesting is put that down and step into the space of asking quality questions. Now, that means it requires a little more effort, but the dopamine hit you're going to get is much higher. It's much mm-hmm. greater, right? And I think the fact that you and your partner, I mean, let's be honest, the fact that you set time, that's so important. That's step one. You just by setting the time, you have created the space.
Mm-hmm.
And now the thing is, now what you're going to have from the book is 12 really well-constructed questions. They're going to take you on a beautiful journey. And I promise you, Tom, from doing this for 10 years, you're going to have a different conversation than you ever had before.
Mm.
And that's a beautiful thing. And I think after that, your relationship with your partner, with your wife, is going to be that much more resilient, that's much more fulfilling and vital, because you have illuminated this space between you, the threads of connection that you have with your wife, right? Yeah. And your mutual project of raising your children and creating a household and supporting each other on your individual journeys. And that you're going to have, I'm telling you, you're going to have a beautiful journey. And when you have this conversation, it's basically impossible not to, because after 10 years of trial and error and creating this space, we've seen it work so many times.
Mm.
You know, and that's really the function of the book, was to put the blueprint into people's hands so they can not only watch other people on YouTube and this having, you know, riding the bike of having powerful conversations. Now you can ride the bike yourself and mm-hmm. have powerful conversations in your own life.
I love it. And going back to the why behind this, so there's a personal aspect to this in the book that you talk about at the start of the book. Are you able to share I'm always interested in when people start things, like where did it start and what the inspiration was initially, or now that you've done the work, have you thought much about why?
Oh, yeah.
Why the hell did you get into this?
Well, I gotta tell you, my earliest memories are parents fighting. 3-4 years. I don't have a memory. I have one memory of my parents laughing together. They're already separated. my dad made my mom laugh so hard she pissed in her pants. That's my memory of happiness of parents. That's the only one I have.
Yeah.
Everything. And the other is, you can imagine, at 4 years old, we were part of our parents fighting. It was my brother and I. He's 15 months younger than I. And, you know, that's a lot to take on. I'm not comparing traumas. Everyone, I'm sure there are other traumas that are much worse. But for me, that was obviously my kind of rupture of childhood into being aware of something greater, different, was reading these two adults in the room yelling at each other and knowing that there's something more. And that led me on a journey. And actually, I had a profound experience in Melbourne. When I was 21, after graduating from UC Berkeley and Oxford, I bought a one-way ticket to Sydney, Australia. I went back. This was end of 99 when everyone thought, what was that term that we all worried about, the end of the world?
The millennial bug? Millennium bug.
Yeah, yeah. But there was a word. It was like 2000. Y2K. Yeah, Y2K. There we go. Y2K. So I was like, I'm going to get stuck behind Y2K, I want to be in Australia. I mean, let's be serious, right? And I ended up having this incredible experience actually in Melbourne. It was a turning point in my life where I just recognized that I could pursue my dreams. And my dream was to talk to people with a camera. On the streets of Melbourne, actually, that's where you're based, right? That's where you're at. So
yeah, I am. Yeah.
And so I've taken this pain as childhood and it turned into a hunger for a search for intimacy. And then in my 20s and 30s, I was a filmmaker, documentary and fiction, traveling the world, talking to people, interviewing them, making films, where I also learned that there was a mirroring when you interviewed someone. As the interviewer, having the interviewee, they were a reflection of me. So I saw how they were reading off of me, reflecting off me. So if I wanted them to relax, I don't say, please relax, don't be anxious. I relax. If I want them to open up and be vulnerable, I would open up and be vulnerable. And that was a beautiful learning experience of learning how to mirror to others, to open up, to create the space for vulnerability. And that then shifted into when we launched the Skin Deep 10 years ago, which is our experience design studio, was to create the space for two people to ask each other questions and illuminate their connection. And that's how the AND came to be. And it was really structured through the questions. And it was trial and error. But on the personal side, it was a search for intimacy. The search for intimacy. And I feel now that I'm 47, I have two children as well, that I know that our card games that we sell around the world, the book now, all our videos, they do have a positive impact in people's lives. And so I feel that circle is complete. And now it's a question of where else do we go?
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks for sharing that story. That just makes a lot of sense as to how you've ended up with this amazing work and this portfolio of interviews and the book and the card games and everything like that. I think the impact that it has on people is significant, because as you said at the start, we don't know how to have these conversations and we do get stale or stuck in our ways with our relationships in various forms. One of the examples I have, Topaz, and it's quite a common one that parents talk about, is your child comes home from school. How do you ask them how their day was without saying, how was your day? And the kid goes, yeah, it was all right. you got to find the next best question. And I feel like, you know, for a lot of people that are workers as well, we wake up in the morning and we have a question in our head. Maybe it's like, what's my number one priority for today? And things like that. The way you've, in the book, how you've described reframing these questions is really amazing to me as a reader and someone that I've thought about questions, but I haven't thought about them. And I haven't got 10 years of looking at how to create deeper conversations like yourself. My question here, sorry to go on a bit of a tangent here, but my question is, how do you create a good question, or what's the key ingredients for a great question? Can you give some examples, perhaps using the book?
Absolutely. So there's in the context of a relationship, and this could be intimate. It could also be obviously at work. Work is an intimate relationship. These are your colleagues that you're depending, the success or failure of your relationship and achieving the goals is dependent on your ability to put food on the table for your family or support the passions of your family and take care of the people you love. So the stakes are high in the workplace. So that's also, maybe it's not intimate what we traditionally think is intimate, but it's important. And so if you're wondering how to ask good questions in the context of a relationship, there's five things that I, in the last 10 years of trial and error, have found that are really effective. One, let's start with a simple one. Do not ask binary questions. There's nothing easier than closing down a conversation with yes or no. Do you love me? Yes. Did you have a good day?
How much?
No.
How much?
Yeah, how much? Where? Right. So binary questions does not open the door for exploration, right? That's one. Two, when you ask a question, try to ask a question that's offered as a gift, not with an agenda. Why are you so upset at me? Versus, why do I feel that you're upset with me? See, that creates a little more space. When we ask questions, lawyers have the famous saying of don't ask a question you don't know the answer to. My mom is a therapist. I'm sure she's great at what she does, but sometimes in my childhood, she would ask me questions that I would wonder, why you ask me this when you know the answer? Right?
Yeah.
It's much harder to shake a hand that has a finger pointed at you than an open hand. Mm. Right? So offer questions as a gift, right? Ones where there's curiosity, ones where you're creating the space for them to be who they are and ask. So a version of that, especially in the workplace where power is an important thing, because you might be talking to your superior or someone you're talking to your direct report, right? Is don't ask a question where by the construction of the question, you are giving the other person the arbiter of truth. To be the arbiter. What I mean by that is, what is the challenge in our life, in our relationship right now? What is the challenge in the company right now?
Hey, great question.
Versus, what do you think is the biggest challenge in our business right now? What do you feel? What do you see is the big, just by saying, do you think, do you feel, do you see, it puts them in the position of their perspective. And that's less of an argument of what is the arbiter of truth, right? That creates a space for, well, that's your opinion. And in the intimate relationship, it's the same thing. It's, what do you think is our biggest challenge right now? And what can we learn from it? Mm. Right? So third is, so that's in terms of offering as a gift, not without an agenda, right? Third one is trying to make them constructive. And that, let's take the last example. What is our biggest challenge right now? And what are we learning from it? What are we learning from it? Is kind of creating the space for us to convert the challenge into an opportunity of learning. If instead we said, why do we have so, you know, what are all our challenges? Then you'd have a list of what are all our challenges. Our mind is built to protect us, and therefore it will do whatever we ask it, it will do, and it will come up with answers. Our heart is built to connect us. So let's ask questions that are more constructive, that bring our hearts closer together versus that defend us and keep us apart. Mm-hmm. So when we ask the question of what are all the challenges we're facing? Okay, ba, 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 ba.
Yeah.
What if you tweak that? What are the challenges that are really opportunities for us? What are the challenges that are currently teaching us a lesson, and what are those lessons? Right? Convert the question to be more empowering.
Yeah.
On a very simple individual level, if you ask yourself, okay, something bad happened, you're like, why did this shit happen to me? Okay, I'll give you 10 reasons why this shit happened to you. Ba, 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 ba. You're telling your brain, and your brain serves, it's there to protect you, it's going to give you the answers. But instead you say, how is this the fertilizer for who I'm going to become? Mm. What is the hidden lesson in this? How is this going to shape me into something better? How can I convert this challenge into an achievement? So be very cognizant of the question you're asking. And we are not. We put so much emphasis on the answers, especially in the workplace, that we're not so focused on the question. If we put a lot of our energy and focus on the question, the answers can be A, more empowering, which makes it easier to overcome a challenge, and B, easier to answer. It's much easier to answer. It's there.
Yeah. They're really, really, really nice examples. I think as well in the workplace setting as it's evolved over the last couple of years, we're obviously having a conversation through video call. This is how a lot of people are working, at least half their week these days in Australia. And the connection then is through, audio. So how you say things as well. So it's, you know, if it's, and video and facial expressions via a screen, it's very, can be very transactional. So sometimes when we're doing work or we're in a meeting setting and it's, what are the challenges we're facing? Instantly, it's sort of like I've used the term, and through my professional career of sort of red brain, green brain, it's sort of immediately turns you into a red brain type thinking, which is, okay, all I have to do is list the challenges here. But the way you've added that extra component to it, it makes you start thinking and feeling about the topic in a deeper way. So yeah, I love that.
I mean, in any organization, nonprofit, for profit, does any team of people working together through an endeavor, you want to find solutions together. And you have a much better chance of finding a better solution if you have a diverse group of people who have trust and respect, who can work together and communicate. Right? Versus one person who's just pointing the way, this is what we're going to do. Okay, that works for implementation and getting execution, but maybe you're not executing the best solution. So creating a space where people can converse, and we can create a space where we are learning from each other and communicating in a way, that means asking empowering questions is really helpful in that regard, because that creates space for more exploration. That leads to the fourth one, is asking questions that are constructive, but to the fourth aspect of a quality question is that have two things that are unexpected connected. So for example, in the workplace, what common value do we share that our clients do not? How often do we ask that? How does conflict make us better?
Yeah.
And obviously, you probably have heard this one. What are we doing that we shouldn't? What are we not doing that we should?
Yeah.
What could we be doing if blank?
Yeah.
You know?
So good.
So asking those, that creates a space for, wait, now again, to the mind who's serving and there to answer questions for us, now we're putting different points, different modes in our brain. Oh, wait, let me connect these two things. Conflict, I always see it as bad, but now I'm seeing it as good. How does it make us better? Oop, I got to make that.
Yeah.
You know, how does our product service people that we never expected?
Yeah.
How does our product not service in ways that it should or it could? Or, you know, but connecting things. So, you know, in the personal one, even this one is just very classic. It's an individual. What's your favorite memory from your worst relationship? Right? Oh, well, your worst relationship.
Question, they just hurt your brain just for a little second. And then your brain opens up and goes, actually.
For a company? Like, if we had a crystal ball, you're sitting around with your coworkers and you say, if we had a crystal ball that told us the absolute unequivocal truth, what's a question we would never ask it? What are we scared? What truth are we? What is our company's favorite lie we love telling ourselves? What's our collective group's favorite lie we love telling ourselves? And what is our collective truth that we hate telling ourselves? It's connecting things that are not nearly usually connected. The other version of that, unexpected, is asking questions that put you in other people's shoes or put them in other people's shoes. What do you think is the hardest thing being your friend, Tom? What do you think is the hardest thing being your collaborator or colleague at work? Now you have to put yourself in all your colleagues or your friend's shoes or your colleagues at work, coworker's shoes, and kind of look at yourself and say, I suspect this might be really hard. So asking questions that put people in other people's shoes is really helpful, right? And then the last one.
My brain's exploding. Exploding. I'm going to have to, I hope everyone's got a pen and paper and is writing these questions down. I'm going to have
to buy the book.
or just get the book. Yeah, totally.
But
they are great. They are great questions. And I've got a meeting today that's a work one, and I've already penciled a couple of those in there just to get us thinking less red brain, more green brain. Yeah. Love it.
And the last aspect that's really important, in my opinion, of questions in terms of relationship is asking questions that reflect and acknowledge the connection with the other person. What do I mean by that? If I were to ask you, Tom, what scares you the most? Okay, you would answer that. But if your wife asks you what scares you the most, you'd answer that. And if the bartender asks you, you'd answer that. Snakes, dying, God forbid my children get sick. The answer would be the same regardless of who's asking it. It's not acknowledging the connection. A question that acknowledges the connection would be, what do you think scares us both the most? What do you think we're both scared of? What do you think you're scared of that I'm not? And why? So that acknowledges our connection. You're going to answer that differently than if I ask it, and if your wife asks it, and if the bartender asks you that. So having a question that acknowledges the connection is really important. And then this is not in the book, but it also goes towards how you shape the question, and especially when you're a manager or you are in the workplace, right, with your colleagues, is this is going back to learning when I was an interviewer of interviews in films, because they're reflecting you back. When you ask a question, if you're going to ask a formal question, you will most likely get a formal response, right? If you ask an informal question, you are priming the response to also be informal. If you ask a vulnerable question and you're opening up by being vulnerable, you're creating the space. There's a mirroring effect. That person asking the question is priming their response. The question shapes the answer, much like the course shapes the race it's run on. So keep that in mind when we're asking the questions. If you're trying to get someone to be vulnerable, well, you need to open up the space and prime for that.
Mm-hmm.
If you want them to be informal and real, maybe you should curse.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
Because that, I mean, it depends on culture and where you are, but that's a way to break the space and create a permission for a response.
Mm. I reckon there's no better example of that, and it's maybe because I'm a parent of younger children. But if you ask them a question or you're telling them to do something in a very, you know, you have your moments where you're a bit stressed and it basically borderline yelling at them.
Yeah,
they're not going to respond to that. They yell back, or their stress response is up, and you get a bit answer basically because you're asking or delivering something in a terrible way. But as soon as you probably read all the gentle parenting stuff, which is sometimes, you know, there's plenty of memes about all that stuff of being super gentle with your kids and getting gentle response. But yeah, that's a pretty good example. Also think, Topaz, in workplaces, we know that managers are one of the main reasons for people staying and enjoying their work. And so for leaders and managers, often the struggle is having their own capacity themselves to not burn out and to do this type of work really well. I'm wondering, for questions themselves, we've talked about relationships with others. Sometimes in this space, I think anyway, a lot of the questions that we need to ask, or the relationship we need to have, is with ourselves. I'm wondering, from a individual perspective, like I gave you that terrible example earlier, where someone wakes up in the morning, oh, what's the most important thing to do today? What are my priorities? I'm thinking of someone that's going to work and they're busy in the morning. They've got to rush out the door and maybe drop the kids off and all that stuff. What would be some great sort of questions for someone just to sort of channel their energy the right way and to not get distracted themselves in that stress state that sometimes we wake up and we do the wrong things, check our phones, and we're instantly in a terrible kind of ratty mode.
Tom, you're really setting
up. You know what I'm talking about? Or am
100%. Are you kidding me? I'm like, you've read the whole book? Have you read the whole book? Or you just, was that a sincere question? Because you're setting me up with a home run right here. This is
yeah,
the
yeah.
The book.
Toss it up to you, mate.
Oh, great.
Who's here?
Oh, great. Okay, I hope I don't miss. But no, look, we are asking each other, we are asking ourselves questions all the time. We don't even realize it. You wake up in the morning and go, oh, geez, I got to do that today. I have to have that really hard conversation. Oh, my, we have to do that. Or, oh, I can't wait. I have that sales pitch. I'm gonna light it on fire. It's going to be awesome. Well, you wake up in the morning and you don't realize the thing that precluded that statement was an answer to a question. What am I going to do today? What do I have to do today? Right? Being aware of that, even before you jump to the answer, when you start noticing you're answering, stop and say, what question am I answering? Oh, geez, I have to have that hard conversation. Well, let me go back. How can I make today, what moment, how can I make that conversation empowering and as smooth and as loving as possible? How can I utilize that potential conflict as a learning experience for me? What on the flip side of that experience is going to be my learning? I can't wait to find out. Oftentimes when I feel a hesitation or constraint, I'm really not looking forward to going there or to have that conversation. I know that on the flip side of that is a great deal of learning. It's like lifting the rock and finding a small treasure there. So by knowing that, I have a different attitude and energy and intention when I go to it. And so being aware that every statement you're telling yourself is not just a statement. It's not out of a vacuum. It is answering a question. We just don't hear the question. So bring awareness to the question. So, and make it constructive. That's a recommendation. In terms of asking yourself questions, there it's also in the book where I discuss individually to yourself, is don't focus on the answer. Instead of spending 90% on the answer and only 10% thinking about the question, if that, spend 80, 90% on the question and then the 10% on the answer, because it becomes obviously more empowered. And there's three parts to a good question to ask yourself. One is time. What's the aspect? Is this today, the next few hours, next week, next month, next year, next 5 years? What is it? Two, how does it make you feel? Vital, challenged, supported, loved, safe. And third, how does it make others feel? Who is it affecting? Right? Because oftentimes we ask ourselves questions that are big. For a long time, I asked myself, my wife and I, where do we want to live? Well, that is a gigantic, or what's my next job? What should I be doing? I just graduated university. I just finished one job. I'm looking for, what should I do? That's a big question. Let's break it down. Let's put a time aspect. Is it the next week? Is it the next 6 months? Then how does it make me feel? That I feel challenged, that I'm learning a lot, that I'm contributing, that I feel a sense of contribution to others. Fourth, who am I contributing to? How am I making others? Am I supporting my family? Am I inspiring others? Am I addressing the needs of my community? Am I tackling issues that are important to what I feel are important in society? Spend 89% brainstorming 30, 40 of these questions, and then choose the one that gives you the most energy, that you feel like that's the answer, that's the question is worthwhile answering. Circle it and then answer that, and it's much easier to answer it, and it sends you on a direction that's much more valuable.
I love that. You got me thinking about how people, a lot of the time these days, are doing journaling. So it might, you know, for them that might look like, I've got a blank bit of a page and a pen, and I'm just going to write my feelings and thoughts down. It sounds like there's maybe an opportunity here for people, instead of writing freehand and just whatever, they could actually be writing questions, a bunch of questions like you're suggesting, or at least practicing improving their line of questioning, and then going back to that page and going, these questions here, these top five ones are amazing. I'm going to answer them to then get clarity on maybe their thought. Have I just made that up, or does that sound like a reasonable
That's
idea?
What this is. That's what I'm going to say. This is the self edition, which is frankly one of my favorites, because, and that would be, okay, what's my quandary that I'm, what's the enigma? That's the challenge I have right now. Great. Then I'm going to pull out randomly these questions, and then I'm going to answer these questions in relationship to that. I'm going to send you this. I'm going to send you this one, and then the couples one for you to play. Let me know. But I love this self one, because when we have enigma, something we're wondering about, create different questions for it. And the self edition just gives you different versions. You know, in relation to that, what would I want written on my epitaph? Have I truly tried everything? What is the fourth way? You know, they say there's three options. Well, what if there's a fourth option? Right? What am I secretly not telling myself? Or if I had no fear, what would I do? So just asking questions in relation to your enigma to explore it in the journal is, I think, a wonderful tool. And that's why that self-edition is one of my favorites.
I love that. And for those listening, you must head to theskindeep.com to check out the different, the shop, but also the different cards and the games that Topaz is referring to there in the video that we've got going on right now. So Paz, as we entered this discussion, I've been chatting with a colleague who actually works for an organization called Ending Loneliness Together, which is an Australian nonprofit. And this is just interesting. I thought I'd share it with you because I feel like the greater problem here that some of your solutions and also this conversation and the questions that you've come up with just to get people thinking is around the problem of loneliness as a societal problem. So the world, but you may or may not know some of this, but the World Health Organization has called loneliness the next public health priority. So there's a 3-year long commission on how to get the solutions right for loneliness. And, you know, naturally, some of the stats here in Australia, which are interesting, is people that are lonely are 4 times more likely to have a chronic disease, 4.6 times more likely to have depression, 4.1 times more likely to have social anxiety, and 5.2 times more likely to have poorer well-being overall. So why I'm sort of shoehorning that in I think most of us don't know how to have these conversations. We do now because we're chatting with you. I think as well, if you think about the younger generation, it kind of scares the shit out of me with my kids that are very young, who are growing up with things that I didn't have. They're learning some good skills, some mental health skills in their schooling very early, which is impressive. But yeah, kids that are older or teenagers, they're not connecting as much. Obviously, there's the rates of anxiety and depression are only going higher, and the broader problem is actually loneliness, which how you improve that is by improving social connections. Maybe an example that is here in Australia that was in the news the other day was a croissant run club, believe it or not. So it was in the newspaper, and it was basically like people getting together to connect socially. They run and then they have a croissant. Simple concept. But beyond those little clubs, it's actually then having greater conversations and better conversations. Have you made that connection yourself around loneliness and how you're really solving or helping solve that problem?
100%.
Yeah.
100%. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's why I feel I could die, because I feel like I've done my contribution. And now the question is just, how do I amplify it? And I say I could die because I was raised by my parents to question what value are you offering? And I feel really grateful that the "and" is falling to the lap of my team, and I is a really powerful tool of creating space for cathartic conversation. Cathartic conversation that deepens your relationship, that illuminates your sense of connection to others. And so that's a motivating factor for my team and I in our 10th year. And no, we're now in our 11th year of why we do this work, right? Because we know that every person who buys a deck is playing it with at least one other person, maybe more than time. So we're just not, you know, we've sold over 500,000 decks, well over that. I don't know what we're at now, but well over 500,000. So that's at least, that's over, it's like 1 million people have been affected just by playing the game once, right? So absolutely, that's a driving factor. And I think that what you practice at, you get good. What are we practicing? We're practicing talking on social media. We're practicing on reinforcing our own opinions. Are we practicing listening? Are we practicing asking better questions so that we can have better conversations? Are we practicing relationships and connection? And it's not a judgment. It's not a thing to put us down, but I think we just need to bring more conscientiousness to it. And we need to offer people the tools on how to do it. And even the videos that we make on YouTube, which is really the repository of our library of over 1,200 conversations, the long versions of the conversations, it's really an incredibly helpful tool, because you can go down that rabbit hole and see all kinds of conversations, vulnerable, honest, intimate conversations that you're not going to see anywhere else. And not only that, but we elevate when your audience watches it, we film both people at the same time, and we're always showing you both faces at the same time. What that does is it elevates the listener to be on the same level as the speaker. If you think about all the media we watch, films, TV, TikTok, and YouTube, the person speaking is who you see. You don't see the person listening, which that subconsciously tells you that the speaker is more important. What we're suggesting is the listener is just as important as the speaker. Matter of fact, it's not even about what they say. It's about how they're connected. And that's why I invite people is a powerful tool that my team and I know, is that we know that our videos are affecting people, right? And I invite the audience to go down that rabbit hole, because it'll deepen your own relationships by virtue of learning from the conversations that other people are having, which in essence is wisdom, right? It's learning from other people's experiences, not just your own.
Absolutely. And a lot of people learn by watching, I think, as well. You've listened or seen 1,200 conversations. Are there any, for the conversations and the people in these conversations, have you learned anything from a listening perspective that you've taken yourself? As in, is there anything that stands out in the conversation, in the so many conversations? Is there any skills that you think, oh, I should try that?
Well, the first one that comes to mind is in the book called Deep Listening. It's listening with the body. It's feeling to listen. It's a way of avoiding responding and listening with the head, especially in the workplace, but it's also in our relationships. We're more of the time listening to the thing that protects us, which is our mind. Someone is speaking and you're thinking about your response so that you sound A, intelligent, or B, that you're right, or that you win the argument or whatever. Instead of listening with the body. The body is the hardware that's a repository of our software. So if we breathe and take a moment and try to bypass the mind, which is there to protect, which comes with the reaction, with the thought, and instead just listen to the body go, oh, interesting, my stomach is really feeling the butterflies. Mm-hmm. Or I'm feeling tension in my chest or my lower back, or, you know, I'm feeling, or I'm getting goosebumps, right? Listening, feeling to listen, and then responding from that place makes a more unique and authentic conversation. And authentic is such an overused term, but it is, because one thing I've seen when we were filming a bunch of blind dates, right? And there was a beautiful question that was said, why do you think I'm still single? And all the answers, it was amazing. We had so many different kinds of singles there on a blind date. And they all said the same thing. It blew my mind. They said, because you know, you're figuring yourself out first. You're figuring yourself out first. And I thought, wait, is that okay? Well, isn't that interesting? You're figuring it out yourself in like this, in a vacuum, like alone. Isn't it more interesting to learn about who you are through the dance of a relationship with someone else? Mm. But more important, I was thinking, why is everyone answering this way? It's like, oh, maybe because it's societal programming. Maybe that's a cultural mantra that we've just kind of assumed is the way it is. And there was, I think, Ben and one of the couples, Ben and Cedra, who've been this couple that have been back with us for the last 10 years. They've been on 8 times. I think the first time they came on was 2 weeks before Cedra gave birth to their daughter, Nyla.
Oh, wow.
And they were just on last year in June for the 8th time. And Nyla's 9 years old now, playing with her mom. So we not only have the breadth, but we have depth too in this library. They have people who've come back over the years, over and over and over again. You see how they're growing, becoming parents, or, you know, single and now getting married. So it's beautiful. But I really saw Ben and Cedra, both of them, but particularly Ben, how he was really taking a deep breath and he was dropping into himself and being present to his body and responding from that place. And he also wouldn't respond until his wife, Cedra, would look up and look in his eyes, till she put the card down and finally settled. She'd look up after asking the question and he'd sit, and he really took his time with the answer. And watching that really taught me, am I taking time with my own answers? From where am I responding? And in the workplace specifically, oftentimes we have conversations where we are operating from the brain. Someone says something and you are instantly defending your own opinion or attacking because you need to win the argument because there's so much at stake. Where are you really coming from? And oftentimes it's not even about winning, it's about being heard. Right? So one thing for me that I've learned from the end, but also my workplace, is when I feel my body getting tense, that's a wonderful indication that there's room for growth and learning.
Mm.
The path to growth is lit by your fears and by your discomfort. So pursue them wherever they appear. So when I'm talking to someone and they say something where, oh, I don't like that. Oh, that's not the way I want to. Wait, okay, why is that, Topaz? They see a different perspective that has such a different response on you. Great. Stop. Maybe there's a big blind spot here. Maybe we need to have a deep conversation that creates a synergy of a response here that covers both our blind spots. Because clearly there's an emotional reaction here. Okay, great. Mm-hmm. Breathe in that. Be comfortable. Play it back. Let me, before I respond with my head, I'm going to play it back so that person knows that I heard them. And just by doing that, this is something my friend Richard Tripp, who was a leading software leader between project teams, software engineers, connecting them with the marketing. He calls it creative listening, which is not active listening. It's creative listening, where it's when that happens, you feel this tension. Before you jump to the response, stop, breathe, and say, okay, I want to play back what I heard you say. And you play it back to them. And so they hear it played back and they have three options. The first option is to say, yes, that's what I said. Thank you for hearing me. That's what I said. And they will immediately, their physiology will relax because they've been heard. They know that you heard them. You saw it from their point of view. They know that you understood them. And so they will then relax. And now you can move to the second point of giving your point of view. The second thing they could do is say, No, 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 no. That's not what I said. Let me say it again. And they should repeat it. Because how many times are we in conversations? You're in a conversation when you're really passionate about something and you're talking and the other person goes, oh, oh, that's like this. And it's really not like that at all. But you don't want to tell them it's not. You don't want to be rude. And you also don't want to stop your own, you know, your own idea, your riff. But then we're in just different places. So second option is say, no, no, that's not what I said. Let me say it again. And you keep doing that loop until you either get to the first option, which is yes, thank you, you heard me. Or the third option, that's why this creative listening is you say, oh, yes, that is what I said. And now that I hear it played back to me, because now I'm not the speaker, I'm the listener. Oh, and now I don't think that anymore. Right? That creates a permission that you're, so it's not about me being right. It's about the ideas.
Yeah, yeah.
And in the workspace, that's really a powerful tool because ultimately we are on a boat together. We are in an organization together with a common target. Mm. And our ability to hit that target depends on our ability to communicate and in a constructive manner.
Mm.
Right?
I think, yeah, it's kind of like creating the space or getting the problem out so that it becomes a shared problem. And then you attack the problem together rather than attacking each other, which kind of happens, doesn't it? Unfortunately, we all like the sound of our own voice, or we all, I guess, sometimes getting that. I pride myself on being a good listener, but I know at times when I'm get a little bit irritated, instead of the tight chest, I get a tight jaw. I'll come home with a tight jaw, and I'm like, "Ooh, that means I've stored up some negative energy today, and I need to do, I need to what happened and." How am I going to improve that and get rid of that tightness that I feel?
That's impressive. That's really important that you have a communication with your own body and you're listening to it and it's giving you indications. I think that's really helpful.
Yeah. Just needed someone to fix my jaw occasionally. Topaz, thanks so much for your time. I've absolutely loved the conversation. If you haven't been able to tell, I'm going to have to listen back to this with these questions and I hope everyone got a lot of helpful tips for today in how to have a deep conversation with your partner at work, wherever it might be. But yeah, thanks so much. I really appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure. It's been really good, Tom. It's been a pleasure. And please let me know how it goes with your wife later today. You ask the 12 questions? Let me know.
Thank you, Matt. I will. Thanks for tuning in to another Well Workplaces podcast. If you've loved the show, it would be fantastic if you could leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, or feel free to follow us on LinkedIn or Instagram and search Well Workplaces or my profile, Tom Bosner. If you would like to hear more about our exclusive events and more about the Well Workplaces community, feel free to email me directly at tom@wellworkplaces.com.au, where I'd love you to tell me who I should interview in the future podcasts. This podcast is really built on community input and built on the aspiration of inspiring healthy change in every workplace. Thanks for listening.